Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello, welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me in studio is Dan Drost, our USU Extension Vegetable Specialist. He'll be here for the entire hour, and there are a lot of issues to discuss, but we hope that you'll call in first. 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you'll tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden, or send us an email at upraccess@gmail.com. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here again. And, we hear from people around the state via our extension information. And I think I've done a pretty good job of training people, because this summer I've had quite a few less inquiries from our extension personnel out state about problems in their vegetable garden. So I'm assuming that's because I've done such a good job of training them. But maybe they're just like me, overwhelmed with everything, and it's just Dan's the last resort. So it'll be good to talk to some people. So, please call in. And if you had some problems this summer in your vegetable garden, and we want to talk about vegetables, this is the opportunity to do it. And I'm happy to be back again. It's been a few weeks.
A few weeks, yes.
Yeah, a few months, maybe.
Well, let's talk about ripening issues. We'll just start right off with that. Since, as I was looking in my garden, boy, it's the best it's looked in a number of years, and it's just green everywhere. And we finally picked our first corn last week, and of course, everyone in the family was going out and peeking at it to see, because that's everyone's favorite, one of their favorites.
Well, they like to peek at it, but I don't like that, because there's been a lot of earwigs around this year.
Yeah.
And so, sometimes after you peek in there, and then the earwig climbs down inside there. And
that's what happened to my daughter. She was like, earwig!
Yeah,
don't do that.
Well, don't do that then. And, they don't get down inside that tight, husk when we have it normal. The easier way to tell whether it's ready or not, I always tell people that as soon as you start seeing the silks popping out of the ear, it's like everything else, it's calendar based. Plants are very much like people, they live by the calendar, so to speak, and it takes roughly 18 to 24 days for a corn ear to mature. It takes 18 days when the temperatures are as warm as they have been, and it usually takes 24 days as we start moving into September and things start to cool off and our nights get colder and those types of things, because it's a warm weather crop and it likes those temperatures nice and hot. Night temperatures warm, day temperatures hot, and about 18 days roughly. So you can see that silk starting to emerge, and you can just say, okay, 18 days from now I should start thinking about picking corn. And then we usually can pick it over about a 4 or 5 day time window, if you want it, not so mature. And if you don't mind if it's a little over mature, probably a few more days after that. So maybe about a week total pick time in a crop once it starts coming on.
Does it make any difference on the maturity of the corn? In other words, is sugar buns going to be quicker about ripening than, say, ambrosia?
Well, no. Usually what happens is the time it takes for it to mature and come into flower, which is the tassel part, which is the male flower part, and the silks, which are the female flower part. What takes time on the longer maturing one is just to get to that point where they flower. So a late maturing type produces more leaves before it will start to flower. An early maturing one, like sugar buns, produces less leaves. And the only difference then that you'll see in it, and it doesn't affect the 18-day part, but what it does affect is how big the ear is going to be. Because you just got more leaf area on a later maturing type, and so you tend to get more rows of corn around the cob, and you get a longer cob, which means you have a bigger ear, which has more kernels on it for the later maturing type. So that's about the only thing. But it still takes roughly 18 days under these hotter conditions where we have day temperatures that are in the low 90s and night temperatures that are in the mid-60s to maybe 70 or thereabout. It takes about roughly 18 days. If it starts to cool off and our night temperatures are dropping down into the low 50s and our day temperatures are maybe in the high 70s or low 80s, it may take up to 24 days before you start to get ripe ears on it. And then you'll pick day 24 through maybe day 30 or 32.
Since some of my corn gets shaded from about 2:30 on, it may take a little longer for those to
absolutely ripen. And you know, it kind of depends. We're looking at real world situations where you're talking corn in a cornfield where it's getting bright sunlight, you know, from sun up to sun down, so to speak, and those kind of conditions, yeah, you're going to expect a little bit more rapid maturing, but still it has to do with how many leaves the plant has to initiate from a maturity perspective, and then how big that ear is going to be.
Okay, now I want to get into talking about this second and third ears on corn. And we had a fascinating conversation last year, and so I changed the way I did things because of it. But first, we've got Tom in Logan. Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
What's doing,
wow.
Tom? How the heck have you been?
This is 2 weeks in a row. What am I going to do?
No kidding. I think I'm on a roll here.
Either that or you.
When I heard that Dan Ross was going to be on, I just held back a couple of minutes because I knew he'd have the answer to my question.
Okay, what's the problem?
Now, I got no problem. I picked my garlic came in about 2 weeks early, if not a little earlier than that. And so I pulled the whole thing and let it dry out and all that. What do I do with it between now and when it gets cold?
Well, it's just, you know, you want to maintain it and store it cool and dry, so as cool as you can get it. So if it's dry, like you said, I dried it out, you know, find a cool spot for it. And, you know, the coolest spot you probably have is somewhere in your cellar, and put it there.
Well, you know, that's what I did, and then I could smell it kind of getting funny.
Did you go in and check and see whether it was going a little bit, you know, we're getting some mold or something like that in it?
That's what it kind of was smelling like, and I started feeling the sheath on each of the cloves, and they were kind of feeling a little moist, so I took them back out. I got them in the garage where it stays pretty warm, but it's dry in there.
Yeah, well, you know, that's going to be okay. You know, obviously you didn't quite have them dry enough then. You think you do, and before you put them away, they need to be relatively dry. And if you've got the neck on it and you've got the leaf on it and stuff, and that's not dried out good, you know, that's going to happen.
Well, you know, that's what I did, is I let all that stuff dry off. Yeah, I mean, it was just crumbly, and
okay.
Cut the necks off, put it in some storage containers, and I thought I was good to go. But maybe it was just a little too moist downstairs. And
well, and that can happen, you know, those cellars sometimes, you know, we want a little bit of humidity in there, but you know, mine never is that, and I've never had that problem. So it may just be that you thought you were dry enough, Tom, and it wasn't.
Well, I'm going to buy that from you.
Okay.
Hey, guys, thanks a million. I will talk with you all later.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Bye-bye. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. Email us at upraccess@gmail.com or tweet us a question at #AUGarden. So looking at the corn, I've always thought, I want to get that second ear. Why can I never get the second ear? It seems like the only ones that ever develop almost a full second ear are the ones on the corners or
right.
The ones on the ends.
Right.
Everything else, it's not even worth it.
Yep, that's right.
So last year you told me about something, and I changed up what I'm doing.
You can get a second ear on everything, and you know, if you go back to the old literature where they used to plant corn on about a one foot by 1.5 foot or thereabouts in row spacing, and then they had rows that were maybe 2 foot apart where you had all this space around them. It wasn't uncommon to get multiple ears. Our newer varieties are all kind of genetically programmed to really produce only one good ear. And so we've narrowed our row spacings down. We've crammed more plants per row, you know, at 7 inches apart, 8 inches apart. And as a result of that, along with the genetics, the concentration of plants that we have in the field is going to drive the plant toward producing only one good ear. So I always advocate, why don't I ever grow corn in my veggie garden? I don't have a big enough veggie garden to grow it in. It just takes a lot of space for a lot of time for a single ear, and it's easier for me to go to the farmer's market and buy it, or to, you know, use one of the produce stands that's around town to buy corn rather than grow it myself. So if you got more space, yeah, go for it. But the plant is really been bred now to do, you know, concentrate all of its energy into that one ear and produce a big ear that's long, that's got lots of rows around it, lots of kernels potentially there, weighs well, is what the consumer is kind of expecting. That second ear, oftentimes, if you have it on the end of the row and you start stripping it back and looking at it, the reason it doesn't ever really produce as much is two things. One, it's all the energy is concentrated toward the first ear, and if you understand the flowering pattern of the plant, the pollen that's being shed by the tassel, when that second ear starts to emerge, it's always toward the end of the pollination cycle. And so it's throwing out silks, but the pollen, amount of pollen that's being produced is going less and less and less, and it eventually gets to the point where there's no pollen around. And so you've got this kind of half ear, it's got a few kernels in it, and it never really generates anything from it, simply because the flowering pattern is predetermined to produce lots of pollen at the time that that first ear is actually producing silks, and not when the second ear is doing it.
So it's just catching the tail end.
It's just catching the tail end, and so it can't ever really produce anything.
So if it's lucky, maybe there's a couple of plants close by that are a little bit behind some of the others,
and
they might pick it up.
Or you have a second planting of corn that just happens to start to flower around that time, so you'll get some kernels on it, but you never get anything that's really that useful to you from a gardening perspective. So the better approach is to just jam the plants together as close as we can, and we usually say 7 or 8 inches apart for sweet corn in the row, and put your rows about 30 inches apart so that you have a lot of plants really packed together. That gives you lots of ears, but you only get one per plant.
So what happens if you have a lot of vegetation? If you have those rows even closer together, does that keep the pollen from getting to the silks?
Well, it's kind of the shading effect. You know, the shading effect is you're just not really getting enough light to the plant, so there's not enough energy. And so, yeah, I've seen gardeners that have gone down to 24-inch rows and do okay, but when you get these later maturing varieties that are a little taller in stature, they don't nearly perform nearly as well. And then, as you said, all of these leaves are overlapping each other as well, and the ear is farther down in the plant, and a lot of that pollen gets trapped on the leaf, and it doesn't actually get down to the silk, and so that can be an issue. So there is kind of this optimal plant population where you're going to get a high proportion of large ears, and most of the plants are going to produce them, and that you actually get the highest level of productivity out of it. And that is about a 7 or 8 inch in row spacing and about 30 inches between rows.
So can I mitigate the width of the row by planting fewer in the row?
You could.
Okay.
So if you look at, do the mathematics on it, you know, we're talking about, you know, maybe one plant per square foot equivalent. And if you think about a corn plant, the stalk is about 1.5 inches in diameter. The leaves spread out, you know, maybe 1.5 feet. And so that's when you're overlapping to other plants as well. So about a plant per square, you know, maybe 2 plants per square foot. It would be the, you know, probably the tightest I would go.
And I'm also thinking, and I hadn't thought about this before, but my rows on the outside always do better because they've got more space to grow into. So maybe I should do fewer inside, but I can do a few more on the outside.
Well, you could. Yeah, okay. that would be one way.
A little experimentation.
From the commercial farmers, they grow about 22,000 plants per acre. So the commercial farmers are really looking at about one plant every 2 square feet, because an acre is about 43,000 square feet, and they're growing about 22,000 per 43,000. So that's about 2 square foot per plant. And, you know, they do that for a number of reasons. They don't grow quite as much plants as we could in our home vegetable garden, and because they're either mechanically harvesting it, they've got to get in to do sprays, and they're using equipment, and there are certain constraints that the equipment imposes on the plant itself. So in the home veggie garden, you could probably get down to one plant per square foot if you wanted to. That's going to be, kind of on the upper end. And that's why, like you say, inside your patch, sometimes it seems like you don't have quite as much production. On the outside, you tend to have, pretty big ears. There's less competition on the outer side. They get a little bit more light. They probably have a little bit more access to water because you don't have plants on either side of you and on either end of the row that are competing against you. So it's a competition type of thing.
Is there any advantage to growing them the way they used to be grown in hills versus in the row?
Not really. I mean, it was all, once again, the hilling approach was so that from a management perspective, the farmer could get in and do weed management and, kind of, because more of that work was done with animals, horses and those kinds of things. They changed the configuration around to accommodate the labor that they had, and the labor that they had was a horse or a mule going through the garden or the field. And they needed to have some space for that animal to navigate around there, because if you think about how wide a horse is, it's pretty wide. So, they went to a little bit wider spacing. The rows, they wanted to cultivate in both directions. You can think about your rows running north and south, but they effectively wanted to also cultivate east and west, because they knew their bigger problem was if the weeds were out there, they were competing against the corn, and that affected the productivity. So it was kind of from a management perspective. And once herbicides came on the market and tractors started to get established, machines to plant the seeds, which made it easier for the farmer to do what he's doing, all of those things, then we started to change our configurations because we're trying to accommodate equipment that can do that work more efficiently than we can or than a horse could, let's say.
So what issues, are you seeing any issues with corn?
Well, a couple things that we've seen that have been problems that people have said, well, the grasshopper problem has been pretty tremendous this year. There's a lot of pressure, and we've got, I've heard some complaints from home gardeners that the grasshoppers are feeding on the silks of their later maturing corn, and that's going to affect the pollination potential of that particular ear. So you've got to kind of be worried about it, and you see them, they're just going in there and they're just nibbling off the silks as they emerge. Well, you need to be able to get the pollen from the tassel down to the silk, get it fertilized so that pollen grain can germinate and fertilize that kernel in the ear, and if you have the grasshoppers competing for those silks, that's a problem, and we've seen some of that, and so that may affect some of the later corn. Because the grasshoppers now are getting really big, they're getting quite hungry, and so I only see that getting worse for us.
So eat your corn, get it eaten, and enjoy it while you've got it.
Well, yeah, and I think on the from the commercial farmer's perspective, there's just so much vegetation out there, but in your home garden, grasshoppers, are going to kind of go where they go. And I know you were saying beforehand that you go and pick grasshoppers every night, and it doesn't seem to have a dent. And yeah. You're not making a dent in the population. Make you feel good. And if you have chickens, well, that's nice for the chickens because you can throw them over the fence in there, and the chickens will go at them. And that's good protein for them. But I don't have chickens, so I don't bother picking grasshoppers.
And I'm not going to come over to your place and pick them either.
Well, I'm just like, they're there, and they're going to get what they get. And yeah. My grandfather always said, one for me, one for the worm, and one for the earth. And his philosophy was, everything's got to eat. So just plant enough, and you'll have enough.
Well, and then some people said, well, why don't you just let your chickens roam through the garden? I don't do that anymore because I never get any melons. Yeah. I never get any raspberries on the lower part of the raspberry. They go after everything.
Yeah, yeah,
so.
Yeah. They're opportunistic as well. So.
Well, we have only about 35 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to get in a question or comment, please call now, 1-800-826-1495. Email us a question at upraccess@gmail.com or tweet us your question at #AUGarden. So Tom was talking about garlic when he called in.
Yep.
So a little bit hot to plant it now. September is usually a good time, middle September.
Well, in our colder, higher elevation regions, and I don't consider us in those colder, higher elevation regions, usually, you know, early September to mid-September. And in the Logan, Price, you know, Uinta Basin, you know, those kind of regions, you know, late September, early October is a good time to plant. Warmer regions of the Salt Lake Valley and equivalents, you would say, you know, early October is okay. If you're down in St. George or thereabouts, you know, mid to late October.
Same for Moab.
Yeah, Moab, you know, that's when you'd be thinking about putting those garlic cloves back in the ground for next year's crop. So, you know, there's a little bit of time for it. You know, don't rush it. It doesn't pay. It's, you know, yeah, you get some growth on it in the fall, but, you know, it's really the cold weather that we need with garlic, because that's what causes that meristem to divide. If we put too much stress on it early here, it doesn't benefit you in any way. And it's, you want to get some growth, you want to get root growth in the fall, and then it's a cold period over the winter that causes that meristem to subdivide, and that produces all those individual cloves within the bulb. And that's really what we're after. So
wait a month and a half.
Yeah, if you're
in the north.
If you're in the north here, the end of this month is adequate. So, you know, here we are the 27th of August, you know, somewhere around the 20th to the 30th of September is an appropriate time to start thinking about planting. And you'll get good production out of it then. And I can't predict the weather, so I don't know what it's going to do. But that, if you do it, it responds to temperature and it responds to day length, and you'll be fine if you get it in.
Would you address some of the differences between soft neck and hard neck garlics, and which store better, which usually has more flavor, or is that?
Well, you know, I think it's
generally
preferential. I mean, you know, if I like a really strong garlic, and you know, so you know, to me, you know, the hard necks sometimes, you know, don't have quite that strong flavor that I like, you know, I think there's more preferential. I always say plant a bunch of different ones, you know, and find out what you like. You know, certainly like the elephant garlics and those types of things, they tend to be very mild. You know, I like that to come through when I put it in a dish. And, you know, I get disappointed when I have garlic and I go, you know, I know I put a lot of garlic in here, but I can't taste any. And, you know, it's, you know, when I make this garlic chicken that I make and I, you know, stuff cloves underneath the skin and, you know, mash it up and, you know, put it in there and then I can't even taste it. It's like, you know, well, I'm not going to buy that one again.
Scratch that one off the
list.
Yeah,
and so, you know, I'm always kind of looking for it and, you know, lots of times you just don't know until you start trying them. And that's what's so nice about the farmers markets, because you can go in and talk to those growers that are growing garlic. They're not just growing one type. They've got multiple types. And, you know, you talk to them about what your preferences are. I like one that has a really strong garlic flavor. You know, they'll tell you which one that is. And I like one that's a little bit on the mild side, because there are some dishes that we make. There's this pasta dish that I don't want the garlic to overpower some of the other things that you have in the dish. And so, you know, you want a little bit more mild. So you really need to have multiple types. And the best thing to do is talk to those guys that are growing garlic, because they're pretty passionate about it. And I just, that's why I do it. I don't worry too much about it. And they tell me and I go with it.
As far as storability, is it generally the hard necks don't store quite as well as the soft necks?
Yeah, generally. But, you know, it's all conditions too. So Tom was talking, yeah, you get it in. Once you get it in, you really want it cold and dry and the environmental conditions. You know, if you have too much humidity there, sometimes we get it into our fruit cellars and stuff, and there's just a little too much humidity in those environments, and that, you know, will cause them to start to sprout a little bit early. They don't stay into dormancy. I tend to, you know, keep mine in my garage because it's pretty close to freezing, and that stays fairly well there. But I buy a lot of garlic, so it doesn't hang around very long, and I don't grow my own, so it's what I buy, and I'm always just looking for fresh stuff that's coming, and cool and dry, it'll store the best.
And as far as picking out garlic, if you go to a gardener's market or so, what are you looking for?
Well, you know, reasonably nice size cloves. I want them to be tightly, the wrapper's skin, you know, the skin on the garlic to be really tight around it and wrapped all the way up to the neck region on the thing. And that means it's been harvested right. If the bulb that you buy is kind of open and you can kind of almost look down in it and see all the little individual garlic segments, you know, it's been harvested too late and it starts to kind of blow out, and that doesn't store very well. Those cloves will dry out in storage quite rapidly. So if you're growing your own and you have those kind, use those first, and the one that the skin is wrapped around it and really tight, that it should, those are the ones that will store the longest, and those cloves don't dry out nearly as quickly.
So when you usually would harvest around the first part of July, this year would you have been maybe the end of June?
Well, I have a couple commercial farmers that I know, and they were harvesting in mid-June. So
wow.
Yeah, everything is 2 to 3 weeks early this year just because we started the spring so early, and we had a nice long spring, and it warmed up quickly, and it got hot quickly. And, you know, if you just left them in until you normally did, you know, I think I've seen, you know, gardeners that have said they've had problems. Why are my bulbs opening up? Well, that's a late, you know, that's a over mature bulb effectively. And so, they just waited too long to harvest it. And you kind of have to go by the symptoms of the plant and look at the weather and use that as your indicator rather than saying I'm going to do everything by the calendar, because if we do everything by the calendar this year, you're going to miss out on it. My apricots were 3 weeks early. My peaches that I normally start harvesting about now, we've been done picking my peach tree, which always matures starts around the 20th of August and then works its way up until about the 1st of September. It has been done since the 20th. Yeah. And so everything is just fast this year, and you got to understand that. So, you know, it's been nice for some things because they started early. You know, we started harvesting watermelons in late July in our, you know, just our garden plot up at the university where I need them for class. Well, now I don't have any watermelons for class, so that means I got to buy watermelons to talk to the students about when we have class this fall. So those are, you know, just some of the things that happen, and this year is a little unusual.
Well, we're coming up on the halfway point of the program, and we're going to listen to the latest edition of Wild About Utah. I'm going to give the gardening calendar now so I know that we have enough time. This Thursday from 2 to 4 in the afternoon, if you'd like to learn about how to build high tunnels, it'll be at the Kaysville Farm. You're going to be teaching that, right? So you can call for more information at 801-451-3411 or just Google Utah Botanical Center and you should be able to find the information. But I'm going to go down. I'm registered for the class, so.
Well, you know, the nice thing about the High Tunnel Workshop, I think the registration is probably full right now, but we're going to be running more of those over the course of the next few months. So if you miss this first one, we're probably going to run one up in Ogden. We'll probably and eventually run one up in Logan. We're going to do one in Salt Lake. We're going to end up doing one down in the Provo region. There's a lot of interest in putting high tunnels into people's gardens so that they can have fresh veggies all winter long, and there's no reason why we can't have some veggies coming out of our gardens even in the middle of the winter. That's what this workshop will cover.
I'm all for it. October 2nd from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., Harmon City Creek and Wasatch Community Gardens are offering a class on pressure canning and how to preserve your own meats. Pre-registration is required. For registration or more information, visit Wasatch Community Gardens event page online. Stay tuned. The second half of the program will be up in just a bit.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Larez Casanova from the Utah Master Naturalist Program at Utah State University Extension. When exploring wetlands, stream banks, and the shores of Great Salt Lake this time of year, it's common to see tall grasses over 10 feet high blowing in the breeze. While it is very abundant, the common reed known as Phragmites australis is anything but normal. Phragmites was introduced from Europe over a century ago and is now found in all 50 states and on every continent except Antarctica. It can grow to more than 15 feet in height with long blade-like leaves. It flowers from July to October, producing dense, feathery clusters of small flowers that are purple while flowering and turn light brown after producing seeds. Each stem can produce up to 2,000 wind-dispersed seeds that are particularly effective at colonizing new areas. Because of this, Phragmites can take over a disturbed area quickly and prevent native plants such as bulrush and cattail from becoming established. Like other invasive plants, Phragmites is successful at outcompeting native plants. Once a plant is established from seed, Phragmites spreads quickly through rhizomes, or underground stems, that can produce many additional stalks. While Phragmites may start growing among other wetland plants, it quickly outcompetes them for nutrients and sunlight. However, the native Phragmites australis, subspecies americanus, does not grow nearly as dense or tall and tends to not be invasive. Because introduced Phragmites can quickly grow into solid stands, it can greatly reduce plant diversity in wetlands, ultimately reducing the quality of wildlife habitat. Wetlands along the shore of Great Salt Lake are particularly important habitat for many migratory bird species, some of which occur here in the largest populations in North America or the world. The rapid takeover by Phragmites in these wetlands could eventually have dramatic impacts to the entire Great Salt Lake ecosystem. In order to combat this threat, wetland managers have tried several methods for controlling or removing Phragmites, including spraying with herbicide, burning, livestock grazing, and mowing. Dr. Karin Kettenring, a Utah State University researcher, and her graduate students are currently studying the effects of several of these Phragmites control methods along the shores of Great Salt Lake. By experimenting with the timing of mowing and herbicide treatment, as well as covering mowed Phragmites with heavy black plastic, Dr. Kettenring and her team hope to find the most effective combination of treatments. With the continual conversion of native wetland habitats to a monoculture of Phragmites, Dr. Kettenring's research is of particular importance to maintaining the health of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, one of our state's greatest natural wonders. For Wild About Utah, I'm Mark Larez Casanova.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we would love to take your phone calls at questions at 1-800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or your email at upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us a question. I think we've had one tweet, so you can get that going if you'd like to. Hashtag AU Garden, and we'll look for that as well. So let's talk about fall plantings. Last Tuesday, I just happened to have, because I've been putting in some extra iris, I had some extra room on the hills that I had put in. I thought, hey, I'm going to put in some lettuce. So I put the lettuce in, and Friday, the lettuce was up.
Yep.
It was just, I couldn't believe how quick. And I used peat moss. I basically just kind of pressed the seed in and put peat moss over the top, and it was great about keeping the soil evenly moist, yep. And I couldn't believe how fast they came
yeah,
out.
Yeah, well, the soil temperatures are probably right about the right temperature, and the days are warm yet, the nights are starting to cool, and so that's perfect for these crops. So, you know, if you're thinking about fall lettuce, fall spinach, maybe some Chinese cabbage, you know, some fall mustards, all of those kinds of things, this is the time to do it. The only caution that I would have is, you know, come back to our good friend the grasshopper, you know, watch for those guys. So you may want to, you know, put a little bit of if you have Remay or something over top of them, because those young plants are going to be kind of desirable for them. And if grasshoppers find them, they just kind of are like rabbits. They go down a row and they just keep nibbling away at it when they find something that's really good.
So Remay is kind of, it's like a floating row
cover.
Yeah,
so a floating row cover or something like that. So you may want to just watch for them, or if you got some real fine screening, you know, some window screening so that the grasshopper can't get through it. You know, that's the key thing, something that they're not capable of getting through, you'll be okay. And just lay that over top of them as well, and just anchor the corners, and it'll come up. So yeah, any of those types of things, any of the greens. It's a little late for like fall cabbage or, you know, fall
broccoli
and those kinds of things. That's kind of a first of August type of planting dates. You need to kind of get those in. But spinach will work. If you wait, you know, here for, you know, you could get some harvest off of it and then keep those plants in play. You know, next spring you'll have some early spinach as well on these crops. You know, mustards, some of any of the brassicas that are, you know, kind of that we would eat more like leafy stuff. So if you had some kale or something like that, you could direct seed those and, you know, eat some of those as greens for salads and stuff. You know, you're good to go on a lot of them. Now's the time to do it.
What if you're some of the root crops like beets, if you want to just eat the greens?
Yeah, if you're interested in greens, chard or beets will work very well. If you want root crops, you know, this is about the right time to seed your fall radishes. They'll germinate very quickly. They don't put on a tremendous amount of leaf growth, but they just channel all that energy into swelling that root, and you'll get some beautiful radishes and stuff over the fall here. So, you know, usually when I do seed them, this is the time that I'd like to seed them, somewhere around the last week of August, the first week of September here in the north. If you're in the Salt Lake Valley, you know, maybe wait a week or something like that. If you're down in Moab or St. George, you know, kind of mid-September to late September for doing some of these. It's still a little hot down there, and the soil temperatures are still a little too warm, and you get some germination issues. They just don't want to pop out of the ground, and so wait a little bit. Or try to shade them or something like that so that you just don't get direct sun on the soil.
Do you put the Uinta Basin in with northern Utah?
We're about the same as the Uinta Basin here. If you look at temperatures and those types of things, what their day temperatures are like and night temperatures are like are very similar to the Brigham City, Logan region. So, yeah.
So if I were to put in arugula right now, am I going to see the flea beetle problem like I had in the spring?
You shouldn't, because the flea beetles should be all gone.
Okay.
So this is a good time for parsleys and some of those kinds of crops, which tend to attract those flea beetles, and they do a lot of damage to it. That's why I said the mustards and everything in the brassica family, which the flea beetles seem to like, this is a good time to get some of those fall greens. And, you know, don't worry about how big they get. You know, it's more to, you know, just kind of fill out the salad, you know, get the last of the summer, you know, flavors in, and also to have some crops that actually can take a little bit of the cold, and you'll be harvesting them into October, and maybe even with some, you know, some low tunnels or, you know, row covers, those kinds of things. You know, you might even get into early November with them, and maybe all the way up to Thanksgiving, depending what our autumn is like.
Well, the way it's been,
yeah,
we're going to have an extended season.
It could be, and then again, it could change, we hope. You know, I don't know.
We
could use some moisture.
We did have 0.03 inch last night.
Impressive.
Great thunderstorm,
yeah, right,
not much out of it.
Yeah, you know, just enough to get the car dirty, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I had the thought, I heard plunk, plunk. I went, oh, I haven't covered the tiller. So I went running out there, covered the tiller at 1 o'clock in the morning,
yeah,
and then came back in the house, and then it poured for about, 5 minutes, and then it was done.
And that
done.
Was it, yeah.
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 Okay, so let's talk.
The other thing to plant this fall, and, you know, you probably got places in your garden now that are starting to open up, you know, stuff that is not, you know, having any vegetables coming out of it, and therefore it just becomes a weed patch, or, you know, it just got the remnants of an old broccoli plant and some corn stalks and those kinds of things. Now's the time to kind of get that ground worked up while you still got some irrigation water, and then in about 2 weeks start thinking about putting those fall cover crops in. Now, I understand Dr. Carden talked last week a little bit about cover crops and those kinds of things and soil improving crops that we can plant. I'm a big advocate of either going with hairy vetch and either wheat or barley mixed in with that, and kind of this grass legume mix to hold the nutrients that are there, stabilize the soil, and then also in the springtime when they get up about 6 to 12 inches tall, mowing them down and then tilling them back into the soil to use as a fertilizer source. Those things are really good, and they need to get established here in early September. And so, you know, some of our nurseries and garden centers carry these cover crops, and the hairy vetch is a real commonly used one and is a great one. It produces lots of nitrogen. It fills out. It's a competitive against weeds. So you kind of create this weed-free environment, and that's really what we're trying to do, because, you know, we've probably been a little lax in our weed management over the last few weeks. And so you've got some red root, and you've got some you've got some lamb's quarters out there. You probably got some of the grasses that are just producing tons of seed. And now next year, that means only one thing. You've got more weeds to deal with next year. And so trying to put these cover crops in helps to just stabilize the soil, helps to outcompete the weeds that are germinating in the autumn, helps to build the soil for next year so that you'll have a very productive garden.
Do you really see a difference for gardens that have a regular rotation of cover crops versus ones that don't?
Well, we're doing a project down at the Kaysville farm where we have hairy vetch as one of our winter cover crops, and it outperforms any of our other winter cover crops 2 to 1. You know, so the crops do so much better. There's a lot less weeds in there. And so they really are useful in your vegetable garden to kind of work into the rotation. And now's a good time to start seeding them. You've got sections of the garden that aren't productive anymore. Don't grow any plants right now. Maybe you haven't used them for a while. You know, just those are the places that you want to put them in. And the next spring, you know, those would become the places where you're going to work that in. And then because of the high nitrogen, then you're going to grow crops like your squashes, your corn, those kind of things are going to come back after these cover crops to feed them, and also to help, you know, just suppress the weeds that are there. So, yeah, they're really useful, and the gardeners that I know that put cover crops in claim that they're getting a real positive effect in terms of their soil quality and their crop growth in the next year.
Because most vegetables do better with a little bit of extra boost in nitrogen.
Well, they do.
Why not have it be natural nitrogen?
And it's natural nitrogen, and it's slow-release nitrogen, so it kind of mimics the release of the nitrogen from the cover crop, mimics the growth demand for nitrogen for the vegetable crop, because we put on granular fertilizers, and that fertilizer is right there, right now, and the plant is maybe too small to be able to utilize all of it, so there's a waste. And that's why composts, these green manure crops, they tend to let it out slowly, and it matches more closely to what the crop needs, and so therefore you get good productivity. Now, does that mean you may not use some of these other fertilizers? Well, there are people that say, no, let's just use these, and there's ways to do that. The other fertilizers are useful too, because there are specific times during the development of the crop where a little bit of extra nitrogen can really make a big difference in how much productivity you get. And so I like to use them together because there are benefits to both. Getting that instant burst from a fertilizer versus a slow release from your cover crop.
So other than corn that really likes 2 to 3 different times adding extra nitrogen on, what other ones like to have that extra boost?
Well, your brassicas, things like cabbage and some of those, you know, you want to kind of get that plant fairly large. One of the ones that we are seeing that really likes it is pepper. And eggplant, and some of those plants that keep flowering over a very long time frame, and One of the problems that we regularly see in pepper is we get a lot of sunburn. You know, those fruits that have are sitting out there and you get a dry patch on the side of the fruit. Now, from the home vegetable garden's perspective, that's not serious. You cut it out and you put it away. But our vegetable farmers don't like that because that's one they can't sell. And they would like to be able to sell more fruits and grow less plants. So by feeding them at specific times during the development of the crop, what we can do is produce more leaves. The leaves tend to shade the fruits, and we get less sunburn. And so in your vegetable garden, the same type of thing can happen. I use the ones that are sunburned out of my own garden, but you know, if I was going to the farmer's market with some stuff and I've got a small kind of commercial garden thing operation going, you know, those are all fruits that if I take them, I bring them home with me because nobody's going to buy them unless I say, oh, here, take this one as well, and then I'm giving it away. So you might as well figure out a way to get your crop to grow and produce the leaves that it needs so that it can shade the fruit so that we minimize the amount of sunburn. So pepper is a good one. Eggplant's another one. You know, some of the squashes at specific times, we want to get the vines big and get enough leaf on there, and watermelons. The timing is the critical thing. When do we put it on? That's what, you know, is key to making sure that we don't, you know, stop the plant from flowering or cause flowers to abort or do something like that. That sometimes extra nitrogen and extra fertilizer can simulate these problems and acerbate these problems for us.
So what's happening when a fruit gets sunburned? Is it the heat? The sun is heating up the water in the cell, and it breaks the cell wall. What's happening?
Well, in effect, that's what's happening. It's superheating cells, and the cell gets damaged, and it changes the various pigments within that cell. And so, like in tomato, when you get a sunburn, you get a yellow color because lycopene is the color that makes red fruits, and lycopene is damaged by the heat. And so you get these yellow tones, which are other chlorophyll compounds, and there are other anthocyanin-like compounds that give it the distinct colors. So the cell gets superheated, the membrane gets weakened. Sometimes the cell will lyse, and that's when it starts to dry out, and you'll get that leathery patch that shows up on the side of a fruit. And it tends to be predominantly on the fruits that are on the southwest quadrant of the plant. If you're on the north side or the east side, the sun isn't nearly as hot. Just like on our houses, you know, there's more shading that's going on, so to speak, and you don't see as much sunburn there. But it tends to be the ones that are more on the south and on the west side that have that, and it's cells that are overheated by the sun.
And usually more mature fruit? Like, usually you don't see a sunburn on a tomato, but you're saying it happens earlier?
It happens about the time the fruit is full size. So that's when it tends to be the most critical. And so there are a couple approaches to take. You know, there's a lot of work going on to look at shading and the role shading plays in it. And so growing more leaves will give you more shade. But, you know, there are people that actually put up shade structures on the south and on the west sides of their plants in an attempt to try and do that. Or if you have a corn patch or something like that, grow your peppers on the east side of it to be able to catch the shading from the corn in the afternoon, and the plant still gets enough sun to ripen them, but you'll see an awful lot less sunburn. So, you know, those are problems that we see year in and year out, and there are ways to mitigate it. We can water more, but that doesn't always help. You know, the plant tends to it depends on how hot it is, too. And we've been pretty hot this summer. We've had more days above 90s and the mid-90s than, you know, in a lot of years that I can remember anyway. In the 20 years that I've been here, it just seems like, you know, it's been one of those
continuous 3 months.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I'm tired of it, and the plants are tired of it too, and they show the symptomology.
So the trees that belong to my neighbors right on the near the property line are actually helping me this year.
In many ways, yes. You know, in those cooler summers,
Not so much.
They don't help so much. In a hotter summer, they help a lot. So, you know, it's the blessings that we get, you know, are kind of have to be tempered against what the conditions are like that we're dealing with. And so think about, you know, locations, think about other things that you can do, and certainly putting some shade up can help. And there's this project that, you know, if you look at commercial peppers, I know many of the farmers say to me that they figure on about a 40% loss, and it's all almost exclusively due to sunburn.
Wow, that's a
so they're throwing out 40% of their fruit because it doesn't take a very big spot to be damaged to make it a,
before someone thinks, oh, this is an edible and doesn't
want to
buy it.
Well, the consumer says it's diseased.
Yeah, they think they, it's
everything
wrong with
is
it.
Diseased to a consumer. So the farmer can't sell that. So he's saying, what can I do to mitigate this problem? So we're working on it from the perspective of grow more plant to make more shade, you know, so have more leaves. And we're also saying, can I physically construct shade in the garden in an attempt to mitigate the problem? And is it economic for us to do that?
Would a row cover help with this as well?
Absolutely. And okay. I think if we just, even at this time of the year where the fruits are starting to size or earlier in the year, just putting some row cover over top of those plants, like, you know, Remay or something, it'll take that heat load off of those plants. And that could be the difference in your home vegetable garden between harvesting 100% of your fruits and not. Now, we look at our high tunnel ones just in passing. I know we're getting close to the end here. In passing, our high tunnel crop this year, we had maybe 1% loss due to sunburn. We've got the same wow. exact project going on outside in the open air, so to speak, and walking through that project, it looks like we're going to be about 20% damage due to sunburn. So 1 to 2% versus 20%.
That's significant.
That's significant.
Okay, so in 30 seconds, talk about my beans haven't been doing well. It's just been too hot. The blossoms have been dropping. Talk about blossom end rot. You've been seeing that.
Well, we see a lot of blossom end rot this year. And once again, it's just stress. I mean, the plants are under tremendous stress. Tomatoes keep setting all summer long. And if you're not getting enough water to them, those plants are aggravated by this heat. So we're either dropping blooms, and I pretty much circumvented bloom drop because I've been watering more. But that hasn't really solved the blossom end rot problem. I still see it showing up on my own tomato plants at home. Mm. And it means I either have to water more or I have to do something else. And I've tried to circumvent it by watering more. It solved the blossom drop, but it hasn't solved the blossom end rot problem. So more work needs to be done.
Dan, thank you very much.
Once again, it's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and he'll be back in another month. Thanks for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Brown buds that fail to open on peonies and some roses, especially the white and pink flowered varieties, is usually the result of botrytis blight, also known as gray mold. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. This fungal disease is most common in cool and rainy, as well as humid weather. The disease attacks a variety of ornamental and edible plants and often is specific to the plant part infected. Botrytis bud blast and flower blights can also occur on mums, dahlias, dogwood, geraniums, hydrangea, marigolds, and sunflowers. Look for the fuzzy gray growth and small black specks on the dead tissue. Remove infected parts and place in a paper bag for disposal. Don't compost, as this can spread the disease. And only clean up during dry weather, as moisture helps spread the blight. Ongoing sanitation, fall cleanup, and better weather is usually enough to keep this disease under control. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.